The news in detail on the hour from the WOR newsroom. And a figure from the Nazi era may very well be a prosperous businessman now living somewhere in Latin America. The Daily Express of London reports in its Saturday edition that Martin Bormann, Hitler's deputy, is still alive at age 72. Express foreign editor Stuart Stevens said the escaped war criminal was able to reach Latin America, and we quote, thanks to the protection of the Vatican, former Argentine President Juan Perón, and some of the most powerful politicians and financiers in South America, end quote. The London Express report said that Bormann financed his protection with gold and artwork smuggled out of Germany before World War II ended.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Why is the Pentagon afraid to deploy the most powerful evidence they have against Julian Assange in court? WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Is he, as his lawyers say, a victim of psychological torture, having committed no crime? And a Zionist messiah? Is Netanyahu on a mission from God? Some of his advisers seem to think so. And Malaysian President Mohamed Mahathir says there is zero evidence that the Russians shot down his national airlines, MH17 airliner, over the Ukraine. He's demanding Malaysia now be included in the Dutch inquiry because so far, despite it being their plane that was brought down, Malaysia has been excluded from the Dutch report. Also, 5G, not rolling out in Bristol yet, but a lot of controversy about whether it's actually been tested. Is it safe? And why is the telecoms industry itself the regulator? And a Bilderberg 2019 debrief now as well. Saturday's boat trip. The Bilderbergers have lunch in a castle execution chamber. Or supper on the Saturday evening. Looking at some of the mounting evidence that there is a serious attempt to get some war going in the Middle East with the Iranians. Lobbyists Pompeo and Kushner are there in Montreux, but it's the first time Iran and the Middle East haven't been on the official Bilderberg agenda for 7 years. Other sites that deep state are preparing to attack Iran is the assault on and intimidation of UK pro-Palestinians in Jeremy Corbyn's opposition Labour Party. Will Corbyn himself be suspended for criticising Israel now? And the sacking of one of the last supporters of Palestine from the UK national radio, George Galloway, over a tweet about the Israeli flag. Is that anti-Semitic? Plus, the Gulf Cooperation Council desperately woo the Emir of Qatar, whose Al Jazeera channel exposed the Israeli embassy offering bribes to undermine pro-Palestinians in the Labour Party and trying to take out Alan Duncan, the Conservative Defence Minister, because he was pro-Palestinian. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at Tuesday at noon this week from LibyanWarTheTruth.com. We speak in depth to James and Joanne Moriarty, who were the last Americans left in Libya when the regime change operation began in 2011. Notice I didn't say a civil war there. And they were captured by Al-Qaeda mercenaries. The couple tell the story of how they managed to escape the jaws of death. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday for our Libya special, fascinating insight into what was really going on in Libya at the time. And also you can download that show from dialectradio.co.uk right now. But Martin, let's start by looking at Assange this week. This is pretty serious, isn't it? The Pentagon are saying, although it may be through various other news agencies, that there is quite a lot of the information that they've got on Assange, ways that he's managed to get hold of information, etc. They say illegally, but they can't present it in court because it's too sensitive.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they, in the immortal words of Mandy Rice Davis. The fact is, if they had the evidence, they'd bring it to the court, but they haven't. He's not done anything illegal. He has done what investigative journalists have always done if they're worth their salt, which is to cultivate his sources, and then you get information, double-check it, and then tell people what's going on. And that's all he's done.
An article in Politico this week, what they are saying is Assange will not face charges over his role in a devastating CIA leak. Decision surprised national security experts and former officials, given the prosecutor's recent decision to go after the WikiLeaks founder on Espionage Act charges. There is a sort of separation here, isn't there, between those who have leaked to Julian Assange. He himself, as I understand it, is not actually a hacker or a leaker. He is someone who takes information that's being leaked and publishes it.
That's right.
Or that's was.
Yes, and of course, some of the stuff is because the whole thing about WikiLeaks when it was set up was he created a secure way for people to leak information which was sensitive, so that he could then expose it, and that's exact. And it worked like a dream. Once people realised that he knew what to do with it, they were beating a path to his door to say, "Have a look at this. Do you see what they're up to here?"
Well, some people are visiting Julian Assange, people looking after him, really, in jail, and many are saying that actually he's committed no crime.
Of course he hasn't. In actual fact, there is no crime committed here. Don't forget, he's an Australian citizen.
He's broken so bail conditions. That's what
he's
done.
Yeah, but he's broken bail.
Is that effectively contempt of court?
Well, no, because in actual fact, normally, if you just break your bail conditions, you just get a conditional discharge or a fine. And in actual fact, he wasn't actually... There was no extradition warrant for him from Sweden. And, of course, we got emails showing that the British authorities were pestering the Swedes not to drop the charges against him. There weren't any charges, but to stop pursuing him because they wanted to get
it. And I'm hoping over the next couple of weeks, Martin, to have somebody in who's been directly come from visiting Julian Assange. So
yeah.
The idea, I think, is to try and keep a real close tabs on how he's getting on. Do
Absolutely.
You think the British state will collapse into the Americans here and hand him over?
Well, I mean, we've pretty much done everything they've wanted so far. And, of course, for years and years and years, the story was that Assange was being paranoid. He should just go back to Sweden and face the music, blah, blah, blah. It's nothing to do with the Americans. He's just a narcissist. And then the British raid the embassy. And what first thing they do is they start talking about sending him to the US. The Espionage Act was brought in 1917 by the Wilson government to smash the opposition to the First World War. And Bill Hayward, the head of the International Workers of the World, was sent to prison. Eugene V. Debs, the head of the US Socialist Party, was sent to prison. Bill Hayward fled to the Soviet Union, the newly fledged Soviet Union, and died in Russia and was buried in the Kremlin Wall as one of the heroes of the Russian Revolution. So the Espionage Act has hardly been used since 1917. So it's extraordinary that they've wheeled this out. And don't forget that Assange is not a US citizen. He's an Australian citizen. And of course, in Australia, the authorities have raided ABC because they did a documentary about how Australian troops had been assassinating people and killing people in Afghanistan. The whole world is now we're on censorship watch. And if Assange is crushed in this way, then all investigative journalism will be completely delegitimised.
Well, do you mean to say that The Guardian are going to stop publishing Assange's stories?
Well, they published quite a lot of his stories to begin with, and now they've turned on him and said, oh no, he's a narcissist, he's this, he's that, he's the other, because of course we suspect that...
Actually, it's a different editor, isn't there?
Well, exactly. Yeah. What's happened to The Guardian is they've basically become the house journal of MI6.
How is The Guardian funded? Because many people say they have actually no money at all.
Well, they're funded by
Scott Trust owns it. Yeah.
But of course, their finances are rather opaque. Like all quality newspapers, they don't actually make any money.
I mean, if a newspaper, I mean, we're just speculating here, but if a newspaper is in that sort of position where it might have to fold because it's not getting enough money in through advertising or sales of the cover, and obviously the internet is a big reason why a lot of newspapers are doing that nowadays, then they might take some money from someone with some conditions, mightn't they?
Yes, indeed. I mean, aren't you, because somebody like George Soros, for example, might decide to bail them out, provided they take the correct line on various issues, which
and,
they pretty
and
much
for
seem
example,
to be doing.
Choose particular editors, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The Justice Department has decided not to charge Julian Assange for his role in exposing some of the CIA's most secret spying tools, according to a US official and two other people familiar with the case. This is this article in Politico. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's a move that surprised national security experts and some former officials, given prosecutors' recent decision to aggressively go after the WikiLeaks founder on controversial Espionage Act charges Martin was talking about there. And some legal experts were said would not hold up in court. The decision also means Assange will not face punishment for publishing one of the CIA's most potent arsenals of digital code used to hack devices, dubbed the Vault 7. The leak, one of the most devastating in CIA history, not only essentially rendered those tools useless for the CIA, it gave foreign spies and rogue hackers access to them. Prosecutors were stymied by several factors. First, the government is facing a ticking clock in its efforts to extradite Assange to the US from the UK, where he's being held. Extradition laws require the US to bring any additional charges against Assange within 60 days of the first indictment, which prosecutors filed in March, accusing Assange of helping former army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning hack into military computers.
Well, I mean, they're basically making the law up as they go on. This is actually in defiance of habeas corpus as enshrined in Magna Carta. He's not committed any offence in British law. He's actually an Australian citizen, so he's not under US jurisdiction. And there's no basis in English common law for this guy to be in prison at all, let alone extradited to the US.
Jeremy Hunt has actually tweeted out, hasn't he, that this is all Assange's own fault.
Well, again, that's just completely outrageous. I think if this does come to court, but of course he's now getting very ill, and there's evidence that they may be feeding psychotropic drugs to him, we're not quite sure. But the fact is...
It's psychological torture, some
people say. Absolutely. I mean, the UN rapporteur on torture has already said this is torture.
There's a second reason too. Prosecutors were worried about the sensitivity of these Vault 7 materials. According to an official familiar with the deliberations over whether to charge Assange, broaching such a classified subject in court risks exposing even more CIA secrets, legal experts said. CIA never officially confirmed the authenticity of the leaked documents, even though analysts widely believe them to be authentic. Now, amongst the Vault 7 revelations, Martin, were all sorts of spying and hacking tools used on Android phones, and there's also a massive amount of information about normal, everyday electronic devices like this TV we have in our studio here, the monitors, and the potential to use that to actually spy on people in a very much Orwellian...
Well, that's Edward Snowden obviously pointed this stuff out years ago. The CIA basically uses electronic devices and the tech giants to spy on everybody. They're not going to cut to a judge and saying, we think this guy's a criminal or a terrorist, we need to tap his phone. They're basically using the technology to spy on everybody,
well,
and that's
also
what Assange exposed.
I mean, there's all this stuff.
It's illegal. Their spying is illegal.
In the Church Committee years ago about, for example, using heart attack guns, weapons that fire a bullet into you, which causes you to have a heart attack.
Yep.
Actually, what the Vault 7 is largely about is things... Oh, another aspect of that is using hacking of vehicles to assassinate people. We're talking about aircraft, trains and cars, all of which we know are hackable.
Yep. And in fact, the CIA, Mike Pompeo said to a student audience in the US the other day, I went to West Point and we were taught to be always tell the truth and to defend the country. But I tell you what, when we with the CIA, we lie, cheat, and steal, and we're proud to lie, cheat, and steal. And you think, if you're going to lie, cheat, and steal, you shouldn't tell everybody. But of course, they've told everybody. And of course, most of what the CIA does is not legal under US law, never mind international law.
I mean, do you think Assange is play acting and pretending to be ill so he doesn't have to actually face these charges?
No.
I mean, there's surely some people, this is what the other side may argue, isn't it?
Well, no. I mean, in actual fact, it's in his interest to try and, to try and face them. He's basically been persecuted. He's in a bad. If you've seen, people who've seen him have said he's in a bad way. His lawyers are saying he can barely string a sentence together. And as I say, the suspicion that he's being fed psychotropic drugs inside our prison system, and of course he shouldn't be in the prison at all. Now, if this had happened in the 1776 in the United States of America, that was just about being born, it would have been regarded as an outrage. One of the things in the US Constitution is that the government shouldn't spy on the population unless they have a warrant from a magistrate because they suspect somebody is a foreign agent or a criminal. Now, in actual fact, that's all gone down the drain years ago, and all Assange has done is expose the fact that the US government lies, cheats, steals and spies on everybody.
What you're saying is that Nevermind D-Day, actually an Orwellian state has been created.
It has. We were talking about this earlier, and of course, as we've covered on this show many a time, the so-called Islamist terrorism that we're being subjected to, all the evidence suggests that this is being orchestrated from inside the intelligence services of the West. So we're paying for this. We pay for these people to do what they do, which includes blowing things up, blaming it on people who didn't do it, to start wars. That's what's going on. That's spitting on the graves of our glorious war dead, in my view.
70 years after the publication of George Orwell's 1984 today, Martin.
Well, I mean, the modern techniques for manipulating the population are far more sophisticated than the ones in the book.
We could look at all sorts of things that he talked about, but groupthink is one that the BBC World Service didn't talk about today when they discussed it. But actually, that's what a lot of this anti-Semitism thing seems to be about, is anybody that steps out of that little area that they are allowed to think about. Mm. So in other words, criticising Israel in certain ways which they, if someone somewhere has decided that's not acceptable, then they get either suspended from the party, they lose their job, etc.
Well, indeed. And of course, the Israelis and us, we're aligned with Saudi Arabia. How much freedom of speech is there in Saudi Arabia as they murdered their way through Yemen with our bullets and our guns and our support?
With surveillance so massive now, and Orwell, I'm sure, would totally understand the situation that we're in today, the 5G network, as that rolls out, this is, some say, is creating an enormous surveillance network which will go into everybody's homes. In fact, it enables potentially hacking of your fridge, your toaster, and your central heating system, your electricity supply, so someone can switch off your electricity using 5G.
Well, the Iraqi resistance after the invasion of Iraq worked out pretty quickly that it just not touch electronic equipment at all. Just rely on your old-fashioned stuff where you tell people personally, you write things down on a piece of paper, you remember it, and then you eat it. People who use electronics are bound to be bugged.
Some of the scientists pointed out that actually using fibre optic cables and wires is far more secure and actually uses way less energy than this 5G.
Well, that may be so, but I'm afraid, I don't know much about it because I'm not as technical as some others, but the fact is that all militaries are aware that 5G is an essential part of, you know, for fourth, fifth generation warfare. So whatever the
there's
economics
of it.
There's
not a lot of 5G in the countryside, is there? So we're talking about urban warfare here.
Well, eventually presumably the goal is to have it completely covering everything, you know. It doesn't work very well in Afghanistan where they haven't even got electricity, never mind 5G, you know, but there you go. I mean, the Taliban don't depend on electronics, I'm sure.
To see that down in Glastonbury in Somerset, there's been quite a concerted campaign and they've decided not to introduce, not to allow it to be introduced in Glastonbury. But anyway, so let's have a listen now to a Canadian professor. Well, I'm not sure, he actually sounds English, but it's difficult to tell if he's actually... I'll have a look into his background. Professor Anthony Miller, and he's a Canadian government advisor, speaking here about 5G and whether it's safe or not.
When we wonder if something is harmful, we look to the authorities to determine that things are safe for us.
This is him being introduced, actually.
The World Health Organization, through the International Agency for Research on Cancer, classified radio frequency radiation, that the blanket name for the type of signal employed by cell phones, cell towers, and Wi-Fi, to be a class 2B possible carcinogen. That means there is enough firm and reliable scientific evidence to state that wireless radiation may give you cancer. One of the scientists involved in reviewing that classification was Anthony Miller, who is a professor emeritus at the University of Toronto. In the past, Dr. Miller has worked as a national health scientist for the Canadian government and has been awarded the Medal of Honor by the International Agency for Research on Cancer. Dr. Miller is here today to bring you up to date on what scientists in this field are discovering about wireless radiation. Dr. Miller.
Thank you, Dr. Frank. As Frank said, I was associated with the International Agency for Research on Cancer that recommended the World, or the World Health Organization, list all radiofrequency radiation, that is the radiation that powers cell phones and Wi-Fi, including Wi-Fi, as a possible carcinogen. The classification was officially designated as 2B. 2B is a list of possible carcinogens that also includes lead and DDT. That was back in 2011. This classification was based on the epidemiology and other evidence that was available then. But since then, a lot has changed. New science has emerged, both human and animal. Human, by new analyses of some of the studies that were performed before, including the Canadian participation in what was called Interphone. New updated analyses of the studies in Sweden, Sweden being one of the first countries to introduce cell phones and therefore having people with the longest exposure, and they have demonstrated that the longer exposure, the greater the risk. But equally important, there have been two very large animal carcinogenicity studies. Now, we learnt more than 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I was involved in some of this in Canada, that we should not allow companies to introduce new chemicals without them first being tested for the possibility of carcinogenicity. There is every reason why such a requirement should be placed on companies that propose to introduce new radiation, which will expose all of us. The two studies that have been conducted in the last 10 years, but reported only last years, were one by the National Toxicology Program in the United States, a very large animal study, and another by this prestigious Ramazzini Institute in Italy. And both of them showed that prolonged exposure to radiofrequency radiation increases the risk of cancer. And indeed, they also showed that the cancers are similar to some of the cancers that are being observed in humans, and they showed that this sort of radiation increases the damage to our DNA. And if our DNA is damaged, then our risk of cancer increases substantially. Many scientists, including myself, now believe that the evidence is such that if IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, were to reevaluate radiofrequency radiation, it would be placed in class one, i.e., a human carcinogen. And governments could not possibly ignore that. In fact, fortunately for us, an advisory committee of the International Agency for Research on Cancer has recommended that radiofrequency radiation be re-evaluated with high priority. So we're hoping this will occur very shortly. In the meantime, we all must take care. We all must recognize that we are being exposed to radiofrequency radiation. We must do our best through our MPPs, through our discussions with the municipality, to prevent the introduction of 5G, which will only make matters worse. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Miller.
So, yes, that's Professor Anthony Miller, advisor to the Canadian government, who doesn't really seem to think that this is going to be a great technology, Martin. It's also going to be used at Glastonbury, at the Glastonbury Festival itself, but Glastonbury Town, which I suppose is a bit more of a democratic organisation than Mean Fiddler and their people, whoever it is that runs the Glastonbury Festival, have decided they're not having it.
Well, this is a debate that has to be had, isn't it? we're already surrounded by microwave radiation. And we're also surrounded by plastic, for example, which is definitely reducing the sperm count across the developed world. But are we going to ban plastic completely? Maybe we should.
Okay, so there is some more information on this, and I'll put a link up on our show page to the panel of scientists over in Canada that decided to have a symposium about that with their audience and questions afterwards too. So I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But let's go to Israel now and have a look at the, because we've got a new government, Israeli Justice Minister, exactly the same, no change there, and Prime Minister, no change. Even though the Israeli government is going to have another general election, apparently, Martin.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's obviously some, you know, rowing going on inside the Israeli right-wing camp about who should be in charge and what the strategy is going to be and so on. Very dangerous times for the Middle East.
We're having several elections. We've just had one. There's going to be another one now, but it seems as if actually some of the people who are the main people are just the same people all the time, and they're going to carry on running the country.
Well, that's kind of Israeli politics all over. They have, it's a constant kind of, because they've got lots of little small parties. They have to have coalitions. Most of the, you know, there's lots of rowing, and they find it very difficult to come to conclusions about what they need to do. And, anyway, of course, they often take it out on the Palestinians as a way of venting their own frustrations.
One of the big complaints about the Israeli government is that it's an apartheid government and that there is no justice for Palestinians. So who better to ask about this than Eilat Shaked, who's the Israeli Justice Minister. Here she is in a recent interview talking about her role as Justice Minister and the relationship with the Palestinians in Gaza.
From time to time, every like few months, I'm stopping my work for a moment and tell myself, wow, we are the justice minister of a Jewish state in Israel. It's not something obvious if you look down to our history, and definitely it's a very important role. The justice ministry is a very strong ministry. I'm the head of the committee that decide which legislation will pass and which legislation will not. So it is very powerful position in Israel, and I try to do my best to serve the entire people of Israel, and I hope that I did a good job. It's like almost 3.5 years now, and I hope that I will have more years to serve in this ministry. We need to understand first how we got to where we are. In 2005, Ariel Sharon, back then the prime minister, led the disengagement the disengagement from Gaza, and we withdrew till the last inch, ruining all the villages there, and we got in return only missiles and tunnels and terror. A year after that, in 2006, United States forced election in Gaza, and we got the Hamas, which is a terror organization who rule today in Gaza Strip. Unfortunately, I don't see the future in pink colors, because there are many people there in Gaza that support the Hamas and encourage this terror organization. Of course, they are very miserable there. And we have also a very tough situation in all the south. You know, I think that Israel is the only Western country whose citizens are getting missiles on a monthly basis.
Well, I mean, it all sounds fairly reasonable. We withdrew from Gaza, etc. But, of course, that was all unilateral. That wasn't negotiated with the Palestinians. They, for their own reasons, withdrew from Gaza. And, of course, that border between Gaza and Israel is not an international border. It's just where the forces ended up in 1967 and 1948. They basically, many of the people in Gaza can actually see the land they used to live on, which used to be theirs.
She's pointing out that Hamas is a terrorist organisation, and then Jeremy Corbyn likes to negotiate with.
Well, Hamas won the last democratic election in the whole of Palestine, and of course the West then supported Abbas and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank to break away from the PLO, as it were. Now, in other parts of, do you remember the Arab Spring? Do you remember that? Where we were demanding that unless Assad steps down right now and calls a democratic election, people are absolutely justified in taking up arms against the government. Now, in Palestine, Hamas are the government because they won the election, but nobody will talk to them because they're a terrorist organisation, just like the Irgun and the Haganah and the people who bombed bombed their way to a state of Israel in 1948.
Also, I mean,
they were freedom fighters, of course. Hamas are terrorists.
Eilat Shekar didn't mention Operation Cast Lead, which took place a couple of years after the withdrawal of the Israelis from Gaza, or from the Israeli government from Gaza, which was a pretty horrific Operation Cast Lead was a pretty horrific assault, wasn't it, with artillery and air bombardment of Gaza and tens of thousands of casualties, absolute destruction of Gaza's infrastructure.
Yes, well, when Gaddafi didn't actually use aircraft to bomb protesters in Benghazi, the RAF bombed him back into the Stone Age and put in a no-fly zone just to make sure that they would have to fight on the ground without any air cover. Maybe that's the Israeli Air Force should be put on the ground by the RAF so that they have to fight on the ground with the Palestinians. Then maybe there'd be a negotiation, as there was in Yugoslavia.
I mean, it's interesting looking, I think, sometimes, you know, these things boil down to a kill ratio, total in the Gaza war or 2008-2009 of Palestinians, this is what the NGOs say, of dead 1,391 and in Israel 13, so that's 100 to 1.
And of that 13, most were military, weren't they?
That's 100 to 1 kill ratio.
So it
is. It's not really a war, it's more of a slaughter.
No, but don't forget that the Israelis are people like us. They have credit cards, they go shopping. They're Western people. It's a Western country, except it's not a Western country. It's in the Middle East on somebody else's land. But they want to have a Western lifestyle at everybody else's expense, including the US taxpayer.
Well, one of the Conservative leadership candidates, Michael Gove, people seem to have forgotten that he wrote a column in a UK newspaper saying he wants the Palestinian, the Israeli embassy, the British Israeli embassy, to be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which I was quite surprised about. And here's a US report from iNews on that right now.
The push to bring foreign embassies to Jerusalem is contagious. Today, British Member of Parliament and former Justice Secretary Michael Gove wrote an editorial calling for the United Kingdom to move its embassy to Jerusalem. I24 News London correspondent Jonathan Sashadati is with us now.
I think this is a coincidence which has seen Michael Gove's article get a bit more attention than maybe even he expected. But this is the first time, I think, that a mainstream British politician who's not Jewish has ever stated this desire to see the British embassy move to Jerusalem. And some have pointed out that, in fact, the British already have their consulate general in Jerusalem, which is the closest they have to an embassy for Palestinians. Of course, there is no official embassy for Palestine, but this is already located in East Jerusalem. And perhaps Mr. Gove's suggestion is somehow intended to balance that out by showing that the British could move their embassy to Israel, to the western part of Jerusalem, and keep their presence for Palestinians in the eastern part, showing a commitment to both those nations having their capital city in a divided Jerusalem, which, after all, is a policy that many mainstream politicians seem to intend to be the desired solution for the conflict.
So this is an article from December 2016, Martin, in The Times, Michael Gove. I mean, his plan is an interesting one, isn't it? He's saying, effectively, why don't we just have an East Jerusalem embassy for the Palestinians and a West Jerusalem one for Israel?
Because the agreement in 1948 was that Jerusalem should be the capital of a Palestinian state, and the state of Israel didn't really supposed to have... I mean, of course,
it was the division of Jerusalem, surely, into East and Western.
No, there was, Jerusalem was supposed to be an international city under international supervision.
I mean, we even had, didn't we, Syrian and Jordanian troops in Jerusalem?
Well, they did in 1948, yeah.
Up until the 67
War, yeah. Now, it's interesting that Michael Gove saw fit to write that in the
Times. And Egyptian troops.
Now,
as well.
At the time, Michael Gove was a minister, wasn't he, in the government? Now, in actual fact, British policy has never been to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And don't forget, we've got a particular responsibility in this conflict because it was the Balfour Declaration which led to the creation of the State of Israel. So we're largely responsible for the State of Israel's existence, as we are for the State of Kosovo's existence, even though it's not been recognised by the United Nations. But Michael Gove is actually there saying stuff which is actually completely at odds with British policy. But of course, he's allowed to do that. You know, if anybody else had done that, if some Labour cabinet member had said something like that, or said the Palestinians should have a state, they would have been sacked. But he's not been sacked, has he? He hopes to be Prime Minister soon enough, but he's not going to be.
Someone that has been sacked, of course, is George Galloway from his talk radio programme, which is very popular, on about the same time as us, I think, on a Friday it used to be. And he's now been sacked for what he calls a seismic tweet. On talk radio. So let's have a listen to Piers Corbyn and some others discussing that with George Galloway now.
I'm against Israel.
You've been fired for choosing a moment of a football match.
Yeah. Which I've just been watching all these Israel flags being
put. Right, but the implication, whether you like it or not, was that to the Jewish following of Tottenham Hotspur, this is the implication they took, is that you were choosing that moment to gloat that actually a Jewish-supported football club had failed to win the Champions League. You know that.
No, I don't know it. It's false. This is not Alice in Wonderland where you get to choose what words mean whenever you like. The words are the words.
You've been fired for those words.
Well, look, I haven't been paid for more than 2 months, and my producer got sacked on Friday night before the show. So there's much more to this than you know, but you will know all of it. Ever since Ofcom found against my show some months ago on the Skripal affair and on the Jeremy Corbyn affair, two counts, the show's been in special measures. But I don't want to dwell
on
talk radio because I've already moved on. But
many people see the delegitimization of the Israeli state as anti-Semitic.
Well,
that your issue
is a trick. It's a trick that they play, and they always play it. Who said that to me? Shulamit Aloni, a cabinet minister in an Israeli government, over dinner in her house in Tel Aviv.
You can have an issue with the Israeli government or the Israeli leader, but why an issue with the Israeli...
Because it's a trick they
Israel
play.
As a country.
They brand anyone who supports the Palestinians as an anti-Semite. She told me, it's a trick we play. Now, they've done it to Jeremy Corbyn, they've done it to Bernie Sanders, to Chris Williamson, a list as long as your
But
it doesn't wash much
anymore.
George, listen,
on the Arab
my
people.
Team, Celtic, got heavily fined because a significant section of the Celtic crowd wave Palestinian flags. If Alan Sugar had said, if Celtic in the unlikely event had lost a cup final, there'll be no Palestinian flags on the cup, that would have been an attack on the Palestinian political entity and its flag. And that would have been his right, and he
All
would
right.
have done it.
Martin, the former MP, George Galloway, tweeted, and this is what he actually said in his tweet, there will be no Israel flags on the cup after Spurs' Champions League defeat. What exactly did he mean?
Well, I mean, I actually watched the match myself across the road in the Plough last Saturday. There's a significant Jewish support for Tottenham Hotspur, which is fine, and some of them support the State of Israel, so they fly Israeli flags, although there are questions about whether people are allowed to do that or not at football matches.
Well, as he just pointed out,
these are the rules of the FA.
Palestinian flags used by Celtic led to Celtic being fined.
Well, indeed. Now, we're either allowed to fly whatever flags we like at football matches, or there are rules about it. Now, if there are rules for some people but not for other people, then it's perfectly legitimate to point that out. And this whole thing about... Can I come back to the fundamental point? Questioning the existence of the State of Israel is anti-Semitic. Now, we did not allow the Serbs to say that Serbia included Kosovo. And we went to war with them about it. Saying that the State of Israel is illegitimate is not anti-Semitic, it's politics. Don't forget, the State of Israel was created in 1948 as a result of political decisions that were made in this country, in the United States of America and elsewhere. And we might decide to withdraw that recognition. Lots of countries don't recognise Israel. Many countries in the United Nations do not recognise them. And ultimately, of course, if they want to be a recognised member of the United Nations in good standing, they've got to obey the rules. And if they don't obey the rules, they lose the right to independent statehood. They can carry on doing what they're doing because we can't stop them, although we suggested earlier a no-fly zone like the one we put up over Libya or over Bosnia. But obviously that would require to knock out their air defences, which of course we're talking about doing in terms of Syria, but not talking about in terms of Israel.
Let's get back to what George Galloway was saying there, because actually Shulamit Aloni, we just heard, she's the Justice Minister of Israel right now. She's talking about Israel as the Jewish state. So if he puts up a George Galloway talks about the Israeli flag, he's immediately talking about Jews, isn't he?
Well, yes, because, and the same you're talking about the Boers. If you fly a South African flag, one of the old-fashioned South African flags, you're demonstrating a commitment to the apartheid South Africa regime. And of course, you can do that if you like, but other people are going to fly their own flags.
But to what extent is the Israeli state really the Jewish state? Because there are quite a lot of Jews, Neturi Carter and other Orthodox Jews. In fact, we had an excerpt from a whole anti-Israeli Jewish Congress that was happening in the United States recently on this.
Well, the vast majority of Jews in the world do not live in Israel. They live all over the place, but they don't live in Israel. Quite a lot of them live as loyal members of the political community in Iran, for example, where they have they've got seats reserved for them in the Majlis. The state of Israel, if it wants to be regarded as a normal state, and on some occasions they do, then they've got to play by the normal state rules. That includes people questioning whether the state should exist or not. If people oppose the Russian takeover of Crimea, and many people do, I don't, but many people do, does that make them Russophobes? Do they have to be taken to court? In actual fact, this is legitimate political rowing. And of course, when you've got warfare going on, the political rowing gets pretty serious. I mean, whether a state's allowed to control bits of territory is what wars have always been about. And I'm afraid you can't just make people shut up because you don't agree with them. And warfare's like that.
Well, I mean, certain people around Benjamin Netanyahu seem to think that God is definitely involved in some way in whatever happens in Israel, because according to a translation of the Prime Minister's words by the Times of Israel, he further agrees that the Iranian regime will disappear with the help of God.
Well, is that anti-Persianism? Should they be taken to court for that? That's hate speech, isn't it? And of course, Sheldon Adelson in the US, the biggest funder of US politics, has said he wants Iran to be nuked. He wants it to be turned into a field of glass. Those are his exact words.
So,
is that incitement?
So the Iranian regime,
or is it just free speech?
The Iranian regime will disappear with the help of God, in the words of one of Netanyahu's supporters, to which Netanyahu himself adds, "You said it from your mouth to God."
Well, there we are. I mean, do you know my views about this stuff, Tony? People can say whatever they like. They can say whatever they like, but they can't stop other people from saying whatever they like. And, of course, some of this talk does lead to war. But, of course, war is what all this is about. The state of Israel was created by war. The takeover of Algeria by the French was created by war. But virtually all the settlers in Algeria, they've been there for 120 years. All of them had to leave at the end of the war because they lost the war. The Israelis have only been there 50 years.
The US ambassador says Israel is on the side of God. This is in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. The United States ambassador to Israel, a driving force in crafting the Trump administration's long-awaited proposal to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Well, I don't know if that's going to work. He declared on Tuesday that Israel was on the side of God, speaking at a celebration sponsored by the American Evangelical Group to mark the anniversary of a move of the US embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. Ambassador David M. Friedman said Israel was gaining strength for two reasons. First, the relationship between the two countries was growing stronger and stronger. And second, that Israel has one secret weapon that not too many countries had. Israel is on the side of God, and we don't underestimate that. Well, one thing I would question in that report, Martin, is saying that it's American evangelical groups, because there's a lot of evangelicals who are not Zionists. What it really means to say is that this is a Christian Zionist group here.
Well, indeed, and if you want to concentrate on the religious aspects of it, then you could. But everybody thinks God's on their side. There's a famous song, isn't there, by Bob Dylan, with God on our side. The Palestinians think they've got God on their side, and everybody thinks they've got God on their side, apart from atheists, don't they?
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. This means that the rights you currently have will be protected after the UK leaves the EU. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Well, we've been talking about possible future wars there and the brewing conflict increasing between the Israelis and the Iranians. This is something that was being discussed at Bilderberg, Martin. Just to do a brief, debrief from that, it was quite clear because, you know, after we spoke to Charlie Skelton last week, Pompeo did arrive, most certainly, but it was the first time on the official Bilderberg agenda for 7 years that Iran and the Middle East was not on the agenda.
Well, that doesn't mean it wasn't on the agenda. It's just what the official agenda is, doesn't it? I mean, no doubt discussions over coffee and cocktails can be about anything you like.
What about the intimidation of UK pro-Palestinians in Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party? And do you think it's possible that Corbyn might himself be suspended from the Labour Party?
Well, we know, and I don't know if you've still got the clip here, that the Al Jazeera did a sting on the Israeli embassy, which showed that they were definitely interfering in internal Labour Party politics to try and get rid of people they weren't happy with. Spending US taxpayers' money ultimately to try and control British politics. Is that interference in our elections? I think it is, isn't it?
Interesting also that after that programme, amazingly, Al Jazeera and Qatar were blockaded by the Gulf Cooperation Council states like Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, that wasn't because of that, because they've got rows with the Saudis about other things. But yes, I mean, the fact is that
is it that Al Jazeera does a programme like that and not the BBC?
Well, because that's
all about UK politics.
Well, indeed. I mean, basically, it depends upon, you know, the BBC didn't do it because they were ultimately for the British government and the British establishment, and the British establishment supports the Zionist state. Qatar is in a different position. So, of course, they then, you know, what's happened in English language international broadcasting is it's not just the monopoly anymore.
What we heard Norman Finkelstein say last week was that it's not just about Israel. It's actually about the whole of the British establishment that Jeremy Corbyn's threatening.
Well, it is, because don't forget that underlying all of this, the deep state in the US and Britain is closely allied with the deep state in Israel. And as I said earlier, all the evidence suggests that they're allied with Saudis and that they're all orchestrating Islamist terrorism in order to try and pursue an agenda.
You use this term deep state. What do you really mean by that?
Well, everybody's using it now. I mean, years ago, I'd be one of the few people who would be using such a term. But now everybody's using it because it's pretty obvious what's going on. Underlying all of this, in Afghanistan in the 1980s, a lot of the Soviet bloc weaponry that was supplied to the Mujahideen was supplied from Israel, which is stuff they'd captured from the Syrians and others in previous conflicts. And the British military trained Al-Qaeda, as it then was, and as Robin Cook said, Al-Qaeda was just means the database. This is when he was Foreign Secretary.
Just before he died, that article was published in the Guardian.
Yeah, he said what it means is the database. It was originally a hard drive held in Jordan, which basically listed all the people from Libya or elsewhere in the world who'd been recruited by MI6 and the CIA with Mossad watching to be infiltrated into Afghanistan to fight the Russians. And of course they've been infiltrating into Syria, they're now being infiltrated back into Libya, and the various white helmets, for example, were rescued from Syria as the Syrian army took over various areas by the Israelis. The alliance between Islamic fundamentalism and Jewish fundamentalism is pretty clear, and of course MI6 and the CIA are also involved, even though they're goyim. Now, in actual fact, what we're dealing with here is evil people with evil ideas, and it's nothing to do with them being Jewish, non-Jewish, or whatever. We've got imperialism here. It's just imperialism red in tooth and claw.
So do you think that people are using the sort of mantle of Judaism, of Christianity, of Islam, in order to just get away with stuff, effectively? Well, we know, don't we, during the Second World War, at the end of the Second World War, particularly, the Vatican used its influence in order to help some of the most serious Nazi war criminals escape, along the rat lines, for example.
Let's be absolutely clear. I've got no objection to anybody's religious beliefs. I judge people by what they do, not what what they say. I don't care what they believe. I want to see them do the right thing. And the idea that because you're Jewish, you're beyond criticism, that's absurd. Nobody's beyond criticism. And that doesn't mean that many Jews do not agree with what the Israelis are doing. And some of them don't even accept the state of Israel. The idea that all Jews everywhere think the state of Israel is wonderful is just simply wrong. There's loads of Iranian Jews, for example, who could emigrate to Israel, but they choose not to. They're quite happy living in Iran, and they're Iranian.
Well, on the subject of Israel, there's also a story out a few weeks ago, which is in the Financial Times and nowhere else, about something called Pegasus 3, which is an Israeli spyware, which looks extremely worrying, which is potentially being used in the hacking of the phone of Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered.
Well, indeed. I mean, the alliance between Islamist extremism and Israeli extremism is very interesting and repays close attention.
There was a report about this on the World Service on World Update, which we'll listen to now with Dan Damon.
Well, I spoke to Mehul Srivastava. He's the Financial Times correspondent in Tel Aviv. He told me about the Pegasus 3 software.
What our reporting has shown is that Pegasus 3, which has been around for about a year and a half, maybe two perhaps longer, is an incredibly sophisticated piece of malware, which a company in Israel, which sells to intelligence agencies and to governments around the world, has been marketing as a way to get into a high-value target cell phone without them knowing about it, without them having to click on anything, without them having to make a mistake with their phone. It just happens in the background. And in the world of intelligence gathering, it's a bit like the Holy Grail to be able to infect somebody's phone and then to hover in the background for a day or for a year, for as long as you need. You can turn on the microphone, you can turn on the GPS, you can go through emails, WhatsApp, and iMessage, which are technically encrypted or unencrypted when they live on the phone, so they can look through it. So it is this piece of software, essentially, that was developed by a very sophisticated Israeli company and sold to law enforcement and intelligence agencies around the world with the approval of the Israeli government.
And it uses a vulnerability in the WhatsApp messaging app.
So this company has various different ways of getting into people's phones. They advertise them as something called attack vectors. The one that we were most interested in is the possibility that they were able to use a vulnerability inside WhatsApp to not just get into your WhatsApp messages, but to use that as a way to get into your entire phone. Our understanding is that since we started reporting this, WhatsApp has fixed this vulnerability. There was a patch that they did to the servers last week, and I think they're releasing an update that should probably be on your phone right now, too.
Do you have any doubt, though, that the company we're talking about, NSO, will find another way?
That's what the company's advertising pitch is. No matter what happens, no matter what Apple does, no matter what WhatsApp does, no matter what Google and Android do, we find a way into your phone because they have ongoing contracts worth $200, $250 million with countries around the world. And you can't have too much downtime because then they'll start complaining. But this is a very secretive but also quite innovative company. I find it interesting that a company with 500-600 engineers has managed to thwart whatever Apple, one of the most valuable companies in the world, is throwing at it, or WhatsApp, which has built its reputation on encryption and secrecy.
The Israeli government, as you mentioned, approves the customers to which this company sells these extremely clever malware programs. Who are they selling them to, then?
Well, the company obviously does not discuss its clients, and they don't confirm anything, even if you bring it up to them. But there is a general sense that the Israeli Ministry of Defense is eager to approve sales to countries with which Israel may not have very good or even official relations with, because you live in the Middle East now, where the new priority is Iran. And that helps you create some kind of connection with the intelligence community on the other side of the fence that hasn't spoken to you in years. And NSO's software is the way to open that door. I think they're quite happy to do it. But to be clear, the company's never confirmed who it sells to, but human rights campaigners and researchers at places like the University of Toronto, they've been tracking this software, the way it travels through the internet, and they think there's like 45 countries that they've seen it in action: Bahrain, Morocco, places like that, Saudi Arabia, of course, the UAE, countries with worrying human rights records.
And the issue of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi came up in your reporting. What's the link there?
So Mr. Khashoggi has a friend, Omar Abdulaziz, who lives in Canada, and Mr. Abdulaziz has alleged in a lawsuit that's filed both here in Israel and in Cyprus that some version of Pegasus, either Pegasus 2 or Pegasus 3, but probably Pegasus 2, was used to compromise his phone because he's a dissident, and then through his phone to monitor his conversations with Mr. Khashoggi. The company strongly denies this, by the way. They have made it clear they've gone through an exhaustive audit trail of all their clients, and that it never was used to infect Mr. Khashoggi's phone. But that's not the allegation. The allegation is that one of Mr. Khashoggi's friends had his phones infected because he's a Saudi dissident, and that led them to understand more about Mr. Khashoggi's work. It's certainly quite a serious charge, and it's making its way through civil cases here in Israel, so I think we'll see more details on that.
And one of the many remarkable things about this story, as you're telling it, is that in the past we thought this kind of thing was only possible by governments with big cyber agencies like GCHQ in the UK or the NSA in the States, but now this is available for sale.
Commercially available for sale, the company says, and the Israeli government guarantees only to intelligence agencies and to law enforcement around the world. But here, the thing I find most interesting is that we know about NSO because it's the largest player, but we also know that there's smaller players out there who are also selling some variation of this service. I think one of the questions a lot of people who are worried about privacy and security have to ask is, how much are Apple and WhatsApp and Google and all these companies doing to thwart our information from becoming freely available to a sophisticated malware attacker? Their defense is always, well, look, for a company like this, for intelligence agencies, the number of targets is very small, maybe a few thousand around the world. We have millions, billions of users. But I find it interesting that this company has spent 10 years advertising this very ability, which is to thwart two of the most powerful companies in the world, and to get into your phone that way.
Do Israeli ministers use smartphones?
Many of them don't, actually, to be honest. I have met with several senior ministers who either don't use phones themselves or make sure they only use phones that their assistants carry. But I think that's mostly because of a fear that there is significant surveillance of their work from neighboring countries with whom they don't have. They spy on everybody and everybody spies on them. Might as well not have a smartphone. But remember, the Israeli government has developed its own secure network, and there's a huge business opportunity for cell phones like this, which promise that they can't be hacked, including one that's being run by the founders of NSO itself.
Mehul Srivastava from the Financial Times in Tel Aviv. So update your WhatsApp app, assuming you think you're important enough to be hacked by a government.
Martin, what we hear is, thanks very much to the World Service, BBC, and to Dan Damon and the World Update programme, a story that only appeared in the Financial Times, nowhere else, Martin. It just shows you, doesn't it, all this stuff about Huawei we're hearing. Actually, our phones are being hacked by our own intelligence services all the time, and Android is just as vulnerable.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, the suggestion, people are kind of aware that our intelligence services are hacking our phones and the Israelis can hack them, but as long as you said, as long as we're not doing anything, what's the problem? But of course, modern surveillance, because of the computers they've got,
yeah, but the point here is it's
mass surveillance.
This software has just been handed over to the Saudis.
Well, it hasn't. Yes, and of course, but the Saudis and the Israelis are in a very close relationship, and they have been for years. And of course, there's strong evidence that both Saudi intelligence and Israeli intelligence were involved in 9/11. We're going, you know, this is stuff we've been covering this on this show for 10 years.
Okay, couple of last minute headlines. Saudis apparently approved the Sudan assault on the protesters this week. So it's a close relationship between the Sudanese militaries and Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's right. And all of these people are, and we've got a very close relationship with Saudi Arabia as well. So indirectly, our taxes are going to kill those people. That's spitting on the dead of D-Day, isn't it?
And a US general says Iran is an imminent threat to US forces. The Iranian missiles are on boats for offensive attacks, apparently, according to the US military.
Well, if it comes to a war, the Iranians are going to give them a kicking. They're fools.
And finally, Yemeni Houthis have seized 20 posts inside Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's right. Saudi Arabia isn't a real country. It's just a country run by the Al Saud family, who were put in power by the British in the 1902 legitimacy. Shouldn't even be there.
And senators are looking to block arms sales to Saudi Arabia still.
We shall see.
And Senator Paul is going to force votes to block Trump's Bahrain and Qatar arms sales.
We're going to build a new naval base in Bahrain. That's a good use of your hard-earned taxes, isn't it, British listeners?
OK, time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Although it doesn't look as if we've got news feeds coming in at the moment, folks. You just have to rely on us, I'm afraid, and our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem councillor for Noel, Gary Hopkins, also to Martin Summers, you just heard there. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Billy Quain's Saturday edition at 10 a.m. Tomorrow, and Bristol's Best Kept Musical Secret the Sunday evenings at 7 with Danny Lopsch, our sister show Dialects, here next Tuesday at noon on Libya. But do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless and rest in peace, Martin Cosgrave. Martin, also known as Martian, I worked very closely with on the dialect programmes in the early days. And this is a song from Martian from 2002, known as, I believe he called it, Test Able. And don't let the banksters.
Are pretty well understood.
Don't let the
but
banksters.
When it comes to atomic explosions, the guessing game starts. All right, let's take a few minutes right now and get acquainted with an A-bomb. Needs test able.
A submarine bomb exploded in a harbor might affect a city. The affected area would be a poor picnic site, but might be entered briefly, a pass-through quickly, with a varying degree of risk. Some of the falsehoods circulated about radiation effects are trivial, but upsetting. Their beam blunted one's self-esteem. Enough exposure to radiation will cause loss of hair. The treatment, if you'd insist, would be symptomatic. A toupee. And the condition would only be temporary. Your hair would come back. Same color.
You and I don't have shells to fall into like Bert the Turtle, so we have to cover up in our own way. Paul and Patty know this. No matter where they go or what they do, they always try to remember what to do if the atom bomb explodes right then. It's a bomb. Duck and cover. Here's Tony going to his Cub Scout meeting. Tony knows the bomb can explode any time of the year, day or night.
Duck and cover.
Attaboy, Tony. That flash means act fast. I don't have shells to crawl into like Bert the Turtle, so we have to cover up in our own way. Paul and Patty know this. No matter where they go or what they do, they always try to remember what to do if the atom bomb explodes right then. It's a bomb, duck and cover. Here's Tony going to his Cub Scout meeting. Tony knows the bomb can explode any time of the year, day or night. Duck and cover. Attaboy, Tony. That flash means act fast.
Trouble, soldier. You look a little bit worried.
Well, I am, Chaplain. Just a little bit.
Actually, there's no need to be worried, as the Army has taken all of the necessary precautions to see that we're perfectly safe here. Sir, have you ever been out of one of these shops before?
Yes, I've had the opportunity to see a number of the atomic tests. I feel that as a chaplain, it is my responsibility to be with my men.
What's it like, Chaplain?
First of all, one sees a very, very bright light, followed by a shock wave, and then you hear the sound of the blast, and then it seems as though there's a minor earthquake. And then you look up and you see the fireball as it ascends up into the heaven. It's a wonderful sight to behold.
much about the atom bomb if it would have killed you right out.